and welcome to Cinemakers, Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 26, Magic Mike from 2012. I'm Mike Manzi.
I'm Tobin Addington.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And guys, this movie, whew, I had no idea how much I was going to love this movie before I started it. I love this movie.
Had you never seen this before?
Never seen the first one.
I
saw the sequel a couple years ago.
Oh, you saw the sequel first.
I watched both last night. And we can talk. I'm going to talk about the sequel later. This is the last. I've now seen every Soderbergh movie. We only have a couple more. I've seen those, but this is the last one on my list, on my bucket list. I've now seen every one, and this is in my top 10. I mean, I wasn't expecting to love it, and I loved it.
Yeah, I think this rounds it out for me too. This is the last one I think I had not seen as well, and it was definitely different than what I was expecting. We'll get into that. And yeah, I liked it a lot. I think. You might like it more than I did, but I definitely walked away with a different impression than I was expecting. It was certainly not the movie I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I had seen it when it came out on DVD. I remember sort of liking it, not loving it, but it was sort of mid-hype, and there was all kinds of stuff going on.
Oh, so much hype.
Yeah, and so it felt very slight. And watching it this time, I think this is a pretty brilliant movie in all kinds of ways. I mean, it's really, really sly. It's really, really fun. I tweeted out as I was watching it something about it being sort of, you know, amazingly watchable. And I got a response from a friend of mine who's a filmmaker in the UK, a woman there, and she wrote back, she thinks it's a masterpiece. So she, you know, wrote back, it's a masterpiece. And I don't think she was being ironic. And I think there's something to that. We'll get into it as we go. But yeah, I really, really, really enjoyed rewatching this movie.
So all I knew about this franchise, and it's going to end at two, because Mike asked me today, he's like, are they going to make a third one? And I Googled, and I think the top hit is Channing Tatum has no interest in making a third Magic Mike. So I guess this
is... nowadays, in the interest of my new podcast, I need to cover all the bases and find out if it's available.
I mean, I guess, you know, in nomenclature, it should have been Magic Mike, then XL, then XXL. But, you know, they jumped right to the big finale.
Triple XL.
I like that. But all I knew about this franchise was that Channing Tatum was obviously in it. And for evidence of my love of Channing Tatum, you just go check out Magic Mike's here on the podcast network, where me and Joe 2 go through all of his films one by one. We're going to get to these eventually. But I knew that they were about Magic Mike the stripper as Channing's sort of background. I knew that the Alamo Drafthouse has rowdy film screenings of these where, you know, Alamo Drafthouse, known for its quiet rules, will let women or men, whoever, go and, like, you know, shout at the screen and just get really into it like they were in the crowd. So that's pretty cool. And I knew that the sequel, which I want to talk about later because I watched both last night, like I said, the sequel was beloved by, like, people whose opinions of movies I really, really respect. And I watched it a couple years ago and I was like, this is all right. But then watching both together last night, I was like, oh, this sequel is amazing.
And Soderbergh didn't direct the sequel, right? But did he have anything to do
with
it? No,
I think he was a producer.
And he was the DP.
Oh, wow.
Oh, was he really?
That's my memory, is that he was, under one of his pseudonyms, was shooting it.
It looks beautiful.
Yeah, there's a really interesting thing done with the color gel for the daytime real world stuff that was really kind of cool.
Oh, well, I was saying the sequel looks beautiful. I think the sequel looks better than this one. This one has a weird, kind of, like the gel, like, that's... I don't know why. I mean, like, I understand, like, it's to sort of separate the two lifestyles, but, like, why is it so yellow? Like, what do you think?
I actually took it to be sort of more green tinge, just that for money, that they were just trying to see money all day or something like that. Or they were just blinded by the money aspect of their career.
I think it has more to do with the fact that the... Again, this is another movie of Soderbergh's that ends up being a sort of capitalist critique. And you have these people who are... I mean, Channing Tatum is sort of crushed by traditional money systems over and over in this movie, and is unable to sort of fulfill his dreams, not because he's not good at them, but because he's unable to sort of financially make it work. And the real world itself feels like such a slog. And then you go into Exquisite, and the colors, like the blacks are blacker and the blues are beautiful, and everything sparkles. Like, it's a fantasy world. And for both the strippers and for the people watching them. And I think that's to me how I read the difference in sort of color tone.
Okay. The cock rocking kings of Tampa in all their glory.
Yeah, it's one of those great shorthands that Soderbergh has with his films, just to separate the different aspects of reality, you know, like the mundane, boring daytime life, and then just the wild, entertaining, exquisite, like, allure of the nightlife.
Yeah, it's pretty clear which world you'd want to live in.
The nightlife, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was looking on Letterboxd because I have a lot of people I follow who reviewed both these movies, and it felt like I saw in a couple of reviews that they're like, as soon as you get back to that yellow gel, you start to zone out. Like, I feel like that's where, having watched all of Soderbergh's movies over the last 6 or 8 months or whatever, that's where this comes into play, where you're like, oh, I get what he's doing. I get the story he's trying to say. We've talked about it on here time and time again about this financial focus, you know, like Bubble and like the Ocean's movies and like everything revolves around money. And like, how many times in this movie does Channing say that he's an entrepreneur? Like, he's always like talking to people about how he's got those different jobs. You know, one of the more memorable scenes, at least to me, is when he's in that bank with Betsy Brandt from Breaking Bad, and she's like overwhelmed by how attractive he is, and she wants so badly to make it work, but just can't. He has the money, he has, we know that he has the work ethic, we know that he's able to do what he needs to get done, but just, like you said, Tobin, like, the world crushes him down, breaks his spirit, and, like, it's just tough to be Magic Mike.
Yeah, he's an outsider to that system. However he's figured out how to work the other system, however much that plays to his talents, he is an outsider in the traditional capitalist system. That scene is so heartbreaking to me because she really does want to help, but can't, but just can't. I also like how in that scene you see some of the furniture. He shows her his portfolio of furniture. And it's like, it's good, it's interesting, but it's not perfect. You know, like, they don't try and make it like, oh, he's a savant designer, but he's got a really clear eye. And it, like, I think they play that really well. Like, I would give that guy a shot.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite scenes, too. And that's when I knew that this movie had, like, deeper levels. Well, I, of course, because it's Soderbergh, but I'm just saying, like, I was more or less expecting this to sort of be a male cabaret, the whole movie, in a way. Like, I just thought yeah. It was going to be way more of the dancing stuff. So all of this, you know, Mike's life and the stuff with Adam and Brooke really caught me by surprise. But that scene is great because it shows, like, he's a hustler and he can't be taken seriously in the legitimate world, you know? And, like, no matter how much he doesn't really see himself as a hustler because he's not, like, necessarily a drug dealer, in the eyes of that part of society, like, it might as well be, you know? Like, he walks in with, like, stacks of cash and just doesn't know the etiquette and is just so, like, out of his depth in that moment that you're just like, wow, I hope he can make it through this movie. Like, I wasn't sure if he was actually, like, gonna be okay by the end, and I mean that's, we're gonna debate that too.
It's important to know that everything he does is legal. He works construction and roofing. I think, yeah, he is out of his depth, Mike, especially in that. He has some talk to another guy, and the guy basically said, you know, if you come in with a healthy deposit, we can make something happen. He's trying, and he's doing everything he can, and, like, he has, you know, $13,000, and he's not able to make anything happen.
Yeah, it's not that what he's doing is illegal. It's that what he's doing is under the table. So much of the money he's making, he's not, you know, like, they talk about the construction job. I think it's Tarzan, right? Asks the kid, are you being paid, you know, is that under the table? And he says, yeah. And the problem is his credit score. You know, the kindness of strangers only goes so far when the system requires certain things. He just doesn't have what the system requires. That's sort of the tragedy of it, is that if there's anybody who is going to be responsible enough to pay back his loan, like, he's clearly very careful with that stuff. But he just, because of the system, he's unable to get a chance.
Yeah, that's one of the few times they allude to something must have happened, or, you know, like, there's a past to Magic Mike that got, I would assume, got him in the situation where he needed the money, so he started stripping and all these different jobs and all these different things. And it's just, like, interesting how the movie doesn't even explore any of that. We're only given little moments like this to realize, like, he must have screwed up at some point in the past, and now, like, he's just trying to keep it afloat and stay on the right track and like, financially not screw up again, so...
So I think one of the smartest things this movie does is that Magic Mike, that Mike himself is not the focal point. He's not the entry point to this. It's really, he's not the main character. That is Adam and his sister Brooke who are the main characters. And we see them with their financial issues, their money issues. We see them from the very beginning worrying about how they're going to pay things off. You know, we don't really know what their relationship is person to person. Like, we find out later that they're brother and sister. But I think it's a really smart way to start off this movie, that it's about the grind, it's about the hustle. You know, if you want to come to see this movie and just watch Hot Guys Dance, you can, and there is a supercut on the Blu-ray of you letting you do just that. But if you are here to see the Soderbergh type of story, you have this story from the beginning to end through Adam and Brooke about their money issues, their financial issues. It gives you an entry point into this world, into this story, into this, you know, the same thing that Magic Mike's going through, but we're not just thrust into, no pun intended, not just thrust into the world of male stripping. We have an entry point outside that world.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. It feels to me like it's sort of a distillation of so many of these kinds of economic issues that Soderbergh's been working with. It all comes to bear here. And I think, no pun intended, and I think what that allows you to do is use the dancing sequences to comment on, either by escaping from or the style of the dance number or whatever. It allows him to use those dancing numbers both to be, oh, let's just watch these really hot guys, many of whom can really move. No surprise Channing Tatum, you know, can do things with his body that, you know, I mean, this is, we're in like Michael Jackson, Fred Astaire, like he is a capital D dancer.
And if you think what's in this movie is great, the sequel raises it to another level. Yeah. I'm just saying.
I have to see it. And I remember seeing him in those dance movies that he first came out, and that was my first exposure to him, or at least the first one. But there's no denying that you can enjoy those parts of this movie on that level. But also, I think they echo back and forth into the other things that are going on.
Yeah, I got the sense of that too, that they were almost like fight scenes in Haywire, where like they're not just for, well, somewhat they're just for the sake of like, look how cool and entertaining this is, but they also propel the plot in ways, or like they advance the storyline in ways. Like Mike's routines sort of get darker and darker as he's going through harder and harder times, and the kid gets more and more refined with his routines, and you know, you start seeing more of their group choreography, and they really just get way more elaborate with everything as it goes along, and you just come to realize like, this is hard fucking work, man. Like these guys, even though a kid comes off the street and does join the group and can do this, it's not like this is an easy job that anyone can do. They still have to like put him through the ringer and stuff and see if he can handle it. And it just seems so like physically exerting.
And I think the movie's really smart to say that they got Adam off the street, but he's not good at this right away. He's just basically a hot guy who took a chance that paid off. They're like, he can't dance for shit. He's able to do this after, you know, coaching from Matthew McConaughey, who is amazing in this movie, which we will get into in a big way.
Yeah, but I think that, he's like, just got the guts, you know? Like, he has nerve.
Which I feel like, and this is a generalization, if you're in that kind of mentality that you're a hustler and you're working all these different side jobs and whatever, unless you're, like, really don't give a shit about your life, like, you kind of have to have that confidence. You have to be able to, like, quit a job that you're making $10 an hour under the table. I think you have to have that personality type of, like, I'm going to be okay. And I think we see, even from the early scenes where he's talking to his sister, he's got that confidence. He knows things are going to work out. Even though Alex Pettyfer is not the best actor, I think that the character sort of exhibits those kind of traits.
I think it really helps that I'm reminded throughout the film this kid's only 19 years old. You know what I'm saying? Because he doesn't look 19 to me. I think he's okay as far as the role goes, but I just think the look, he needs to be more clean-shaven maybe. He's just not baby-face enough for me, but it really helps that I'm reminded that, because that carries a lot of mileage. He's not even 21, and he's out there in these overage clubs, and he's dealing with, like, these men that have been in this hustle for years and have, like, perfected it, and he's just like a pup in a world of wolves and everything. So that goes a long way for me. I give the character a pass. Yeah, exactly. I give him a pass just, like, because of that detail.
Yeah, he's not a very good actor, I don't think. I guess I haven't seen him in a lot of things, but yeah, he's not good, but Soderbergh has a way of using that to the movie's advantage, I think, because it keeps us at kind of a distance from him. Like, I'm kind of removed from him, which allows Channing Tatum's sort of magnetism to swoop into that void. I guess what I'm saying is that I believe the character, but not because the acting is good. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because I think he's well written. You know, I just don't think it's well performed.
Right. But I don't think that matters so much.
No, because it's so well written. Like, like they constantly do things with him to remind you that, like, yeah, he is just a dumb kid that really doesn't, you know his way and is expecting to sort of be either taken care of by his sister or by his new best friend that he just bestowed that honor upon without any say whatsoever.
And what's really kind of fascinating about that is the guy who wrote this movie is a guy named Reed Carolan, who's only written four things. He's a screenwriter on a documentary. He wrote both Magic Mike movies, and he's writing the Gambit movie starring Channing Tatum. So, like, it's not like he's this guy who has this prestigious career of writing believable characters. Like, for him to create a world filled with characters so believable, it's really commendable.
I may be wrong, I may be filling this in, but I have a memory of when the movie came out that he was a friend of Channing Tatum's from the stripping days, maybe? Or they had some connection, either because he was around that world, because Channing was doing that, or he was in the world. Maybe that was his insight, that it was going to be Channing Tatum and his buddy and Soderbergh crafting this movie based loosely on Channing Tatum's sort of entry into stripping, but that Channing Tatum was going to play the mentor role and not the ingenue role.
And the guy who wrote this movie, Reed Carolan, did go to Harvard, and he founded this thing called Constellation TV, and I'm not exactly sure, you know, what his role in all of this is, but, you know, the fact that he only has 4 credits, like, the more impressed I am by him.
And I don't mean to suggest that he's not a, like, I don't mean that, oh, he's just a friend who wrote this movie. Like, he wrote this movie.
Very intriguing. What really sells everything else is that I feel like this is a whole new world for me, basically. Like, a world I know nothing about. Like, I've never been to one of these clubs. You know, I've never been to a male strip review. I don't know anybody who does that kind of stuff. And so, like, it's just an aspect of life, an aspect of male life that I had no idea about whatsoever. So I'm, like, completely intrigued about what is going on here behind the scenes and in front and everything, and, like, the way this whole world works. And it's set up so well that everybody just feels like they come sort of, like, prepackaged and well done already. You know what I'm saying? Like, everything just right. Feels like such a tight package and delivered so well.
I mean, we know what this movie's gonna be right out of the gate. Like, I mean, there's no better way to get this going than by Matthew McConaughey saying to the movie watcher, "Hey, let's fucking get it on right now. Let's go." And I was like, "Oh my god!" Like, one line in, and I was like, "I am already sold on this movie. I am excited. I am ready to go. Let's do this."
You know what that reminded me of was, this is like a very, I don't think that they were thinking this, but I think it just came up in my mind, but of Schizopolis, when it opens with like the carnival barker on stage and he's like, "Ladies and gentlemen, like closer, closer, like get in here, like check this out." And it's sort of that similar thing where you have the guy at the circus, like just rowling up the crowd, and it got me ready to watch the movie.
You know what I was thinking of when I was watching this movie was comparing Matthew McConaughey's character from Wolf of Wall Street to this one, that they're both guys who are really, really good at what they do. They're both financially driven. They're both, you know, taking a mentor. They're both being mentors to young people, whether it's Leo in Wolf of Wall Street or Alex Pettyfer here. You know, they're these guys who are really true to who they are and what they do and care about it. And then, you know, they're very different, obviously, in terms of the career that they take. But there's a real, I think, similarity there between the two of them.
I feel like he's all ego. He's like super ego. And that's it. He's got one gear and he's stuck in it forever. He's like a Dark Bodhi from Point Break. Like, you know, like he's like this wise kind of shaman, but I don't know if I necessarily want his wisdom to end up like this guy. I pictured him as his character from Dazed and Confused. He gave up pot, he took up coke, and he moved to Florida because he's got that all right, all right, all right. Like, that is more prevalent in this film, I feel, than in Dazed and Confused. Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this is like, we're in the middle of the McConaissance at this point, too. Sort of like his huge shift from being a, like, an okay romantic comedy actor to, like, an amazing dramatic actor. So, yeah, I mean, that was my one note, basically. Like, when I remembered that he was in this movie, I just wrote down McConaughey, and then I sat back and just, like, let this whole thing sort of wash over me.
This is my favorite Matthew McConaughey performance ever. I don't think he's ever been as good, and I don't know that he'll ever be as good. A match of material and actor. He just takes this role and just, like, rips it with his teeth. What that allows everybody else to do is play within the bounds, right? You have Alex Pettyfer playing it very kind of internal and, you know, like, in his shell. And then you have McConaughey way, like, chewing the scenery with, like, his molars, you know? And then you have everybody else allowed to sort of play within that to all kinds of degrees. And I think this is a part that beautifully serves the film. Also, for me, this surprised me this time around. One of the interesting things about this movie is the way it deals with masculinity and with the way men relate to one another. Because as much as it's a movie about these men dancing for these women, it's more about, I think, their sort of interactions with each other. And Matthew McConaughey is very touching. You know, he hugs these guys. Like, he grabs, you know, Alex Pettyfer by the, you know, face, by the, you know, by the jaw, you know, and, like, holds him close. And he feels almost maternal to me. Like, he feels like the den mother of this group, more than like they're like a removed, you know, withholding father figure. He's like in there with it and dealing with his feelings and their feelings, and he's trying to get them to sort of express themselves. And I just think that's such a marvelous look at a different shade of masculinity that at the same time is all about, like you say, like thrusting his, you know, junk in people's faces, you know, consensually and for money, but that he actually is a much more maternal figure surprised me this time.
Yeah, there's like a surprising amount of comfort with each other's bodies in this movie. Yeah, like, and yeah. I think that it might just be inherent from the job, is that you're just going to see each other like naked, like pumping up your cock, like between shows, and it just goes with the territory or whatever. But there is sort of like an extra level to him where he is like this guru or like the Ben Kenobi of stripping of something, you know, like you're right. And like, I feel like he wants to groom these people. Like he really cares about this. You know, this is his livelihood. At the end, Mike is going to be asked if, or he is going to say, like, I am not my job. I'm not that guy on stage. I don't see myself that way. But I feel like McConaughey does, and he's sort of proud of that. Like, I am a stripper. Like, I embrace it, like, to its fullest.
And I think that's where there's, like, a similarity and a difference between him and Mike, right? That they're both hustling. They both have their eyes on bigger prizes. But Mike wants to do his furniture building business. And McConaughey wants to bring it from Tampa to Miami. And then the second movie starts that he and Adam have gone to Europe to be even bigger, like to sort of bring the brand global. And so they both have that grind. They both have the determination, but they differ in like how that is going to affect their lives. Like, I don't think Mike regrets or like, you know, doesn't want to be a stripper. I think he enjoys it and he's good at it, obviously. And, you know, people love him for it. And he's got the lifestyle to go along with it. I feel like Channing could have done that if he wanted, but his mind is elsewhere. He wants to do what he wants to do.
Yeah, I think that you're totally right. It feels like the movie's telling us that McConaughey could be the older Channing. Like if he kept going and chose to channel it all into this, then that's who he would become, and he'd be just as good at it. But that he is not ready to do that or doesn't want to do that, like he's shifting his focus and needs to prioritize in a different way. And I don't think it's making the movie's making a judgment, like a moral judgment about that, although I think there's some question about that. My read, it isn't, you know, so it's not like, oh my God, you could end up like him. It's just, yeah, you could end up like him or you could go be somebody else. And he chooses to go be somebody else.
One of the things I think that is pretty smart about this movie that I like is how many of the characters seem like you're looking at Mike through their eyes whenever they're on screen. So like, I always kind of got this, I don't know if this is for you guys already, but I got the sense that like when McConaughey's on screen, it's like you were saying, Tobin, like we're kind of seeing like this is what Mike could be. We're seeing, you know, Mike through Dallas's eyes. When he's with Brooke, you're sort of seeing, you know, how she sees Mike through her eyes. And same with sort of Adam. And as he's sort of grooming Adam, I get the sense that he's looking at himself from the beginning and like going through it all again and weighing whether or not it was either worth it or worth maintaining. So it's like he's looking at like McConaughey, Adam, and Brooke and seeing himself in different lights or in different aspects and in different ways that he could go.
You know, I really like that. I never really thought about it like that, but I do like that. Just to change the subject for a second, you know, there's such a similarity here, and I don't know if this is just my brain being on the Zack Attack high for, you know, a year and a half a while ago, but there's so many similarities to me between this movie and We Are Your Friends. I mean, it's about young guys, young good-looking guys trying to hustle, trying to get money. They're both, you know, there's a roofing business in both. And then, you know, at the beginning when they're talking about, like, you know who's spinning tonight at the club, I was like, oh my God, like, when Joe 2 sees this, when we watch this for Magic Mike's, he's going to love this movie. Oh, but the one thing I do want to say is that when they go into that club, when they go into, you know, in the beginning when Channing picks up those girls and he's like, you know, when the girls are here, when they look like that, they want to be bothered. You can see just how effortless it is for him to pick up these girls. Like, I think it's, you know, it's a telling insight to his character. It's a telling insight into who he is and what he's good at and, you know, the type of things that he's able to do and that he's, you know, skills that he's developed over time. But I think it also shows us that, like, no matter what life throws at him, like when he can't get the loan or whatever, you know, he's gonna be okay, that he has the skills to make it in this world.
Yeah, and he's plucky. Like, he has, his charm is not, doesn't feel predatory. It feels effortless. As you say, it just feels like a part of who he is. And, you know, one of the knocks on this movie is that the stakes don't feel very high, or when they do, they're high for a very short time and then they kind of go away. And I, again, was not bothered by that at all this time around. I feel like the stakes are high. The stakes have to do with sort of his future as a human being, you know, surviving this economic system. And I think that they're kind of existential, really. But I think that his charm can make it feel like, oh, he'll be okay. And the movie's kind of like, yeah, these guys will be okay. But I'm not sure that they really will, or necessarily will. Like, the charm has only taken him so far. He has that to rely on, but he needs to find another way. There's no denying, though, that he is an effortlessly charming, you know, individual, both I think Channing Tatum and Mike in the movie.
I think that was a really great reveal to show that he was working. I thought that they were just gonna go to a club and meet some girls and hang out, and like he was just gonna help this new kid in town like get laid or something like that. And then I sort of had like this look on my face when he found out that Channing was a stripper. I'm like, wow, that's how they reveal it in the movie? Like that was really smooth. And I don't know, I kind of felt like I had the rug pulled out from under me in a good way, where I was like, he's working right now. Like, he's not picking up chicks. Like, this is part of his routine. This is his job. Like, I'm sure he would love to be out and picking up girls and stuff. And I do get the sense that that rap that he gives to Adam, it very much feels like maybe that's what Channing Tatum would say, like, when he's out with his buddies and stuff. It just came out, like, so easily and so believable. But there's something kind of, again, sad in a way that he's always working like that, you know? Like he's always trying to have to find an angle to stay ahead, you know, to maintain a certain lifestyle, to maintain a certain sort of way that he thinks about himself, right? So that he can stay positive. And because, you know, he never likes to be depressed. Like he wants everybody to have as good a time as possible. So it's hard for him when like consequences start arising and days get dark and he can't deal with stuff like that, because I think he just wants to keep the party going.
And I think it's a lot of moments like that that really just show how well structured this movie is. I mean, I'm not thrilled with like the third act. Like I think the downfall comes a little bit too quickly, and I'm not really thrilled with how it ends, but I think that there's a lot of moments that come at sort of the right times. And you know, what I really like, another part that's really effective for me in terms of like what I know about the franchise and you know the flow of this movie, is that even without having seen these movies, this movie especially, I knew that Channing Tatum's big song was Pony. And to play that, like when Brooke shows up, when Adam Sandler Brooke shows up, and you know Mike talks to her, she sees Alex on stage, and then he's like, you know, I'm gonna go on or whatever. I'm like, this has to be the moment for Pony. I'm like, it is. I'm like, oh yes, like this movie knows what it's doing. It's a perfect moment. I love it.
I mean, this is just me, but like, I kind of found like a lot of the dancing stuff to be a little silly, not in like a bad way, like in a fun way, but I was just blown away by how much of a routine everybody had, like how much work goes into all this stuff, like how much off hours you have to put in to your routine, and not just one, but several. And you know, guys are like, I'm working on something new and it's not ready yet. And I'm like, Jesus, this is a career and a lifestyle and all that kind of stuff. And that is definitely something that also hit me pretty hard watching this, is like Channing Tatum is like fucking amazing at what he does then, dancing and stuff. I'm shocked that he wasn't in like La La Land or had his own movie in that manner, you know? I mean, he was in the Coen Brothers movies about the 50s, Hail Caesar. That is incredible, that moment. That dance sequence is just amazing. So that blew me away too. That was very fun. I think I had a similar look that she had on her face at one point. I mean, there is so much going through her mind. You know, her face changes and you're reading all these different emotions. It's incredible. But at one point, I definitely had the same sense of impressed. Like, I was very impressed with what I was watching.
And I think what another thing that Brooke does, the actress who plays Brooke, does really well in this movie is that she reacts to this all, like the way that she rolls her eyes at this, like this, like everybody takes it so seriously, even though it's just like the sort of the silliest, goofiest thing. And what I think really why this movie is so good is because of how masterful these dance scenes are. That it's essentially like a fight scene, like it's choreographed like to a T, except instead of fighting, it's, you know, guys stripping.
It's so true. Thinking of it as an equivalent to the fight scenes in Haywire is really smart, I think. We talked in that podcast about how some of those fight scenes were funny, or they had funny moments, right? There's gags. And even when you're not enjoying the humor of that, you're delighted by what these people can do and, you know, fearing for their safety and all that. And in this movie, I have the same delight, the sheer delight and amazement at watching what these people can do. It reminds me of things like, you know, you go all the way back to like Buster Keaton movies and what was able to do with his body on screen in full shots, where it's like he's really doing this stuff. And like human beings are not meant to move that way. Like it should not be possible. And there's a real thrill, I think, in watching people, whether they're athletes, you know, in at the top of their game in competitions, or fighters, or in this case, dancers, who are able to do things that are sort of, that are extraordinary, right? They're sort of superhuman with the same material that we all have, but just sort of, you know, shaped differently and and work differently. And as you say, Mike, put in the time and the effort to get to that level. I defy anybody to watch this movie and turn off the film at any point when they're dancing. I don't think you can.
I mean, you can say that they're built from the same stuff as us, but, you know, let's just face it. They're built from different material than us. They are not the same people as us.
Speak for yourself.
But you know what I really loved about the dancing scenes is watching, you know, there's these guys who are so athletic and so talented, and they're doing such crazy things on camera, and it's so much fun to watch, whether you're in the room or you're just watching the movie, like whether you're a character or a viewer. But then you have Tarzan on stage, and Tarzan is going like 50%, and he's so true to his character. But, you know, there's these guys, you know, like Channing and everybody doing like these crazy, crazy things, and here I am, like, watching for Tarzan in the background, like, what's he doing? Like, why is he not going full speed?
That's the Kevin Nash guy, like Tarzan. Yeah, you know what? It's funny. I realized, because I was sort of like, well, you know, how can this kid just like become a dancer, like, or not a dancer, but like, how would the ladies just like go for him? And then I realized, like, they need all these different types. Like, you need the young buck, you need sort of like the giant, right? You need like the suave guy, you need a homeboy like Channing Tatum, right? Like, there's all these different types and stuff. And I just thought that was hilarious that like he can't quite move like them, but he's got value, right? Like, he is just as much right to be up there as the rest of them. He's got the nerve to do it, so.
And I think that there's a real comparison here that you could draw to boy bands of like the 90s, like, you know, like pop boy bands. And, you know, it is just a bunch of white guys. You know, the second movie, I think, does a lot better job of sort of diversifying that and giving the viewers what they want. But I mean, in terms of like who they are, like, they all have a part to play in the show and a part to play in the movie. But you have like such a diverse array of like body types and, you know, styles. Like, you have the pretty boy in Channing, or, you know, the main guy, the hunk, whatever. You have the young kid in Alex. You have the most ripped human being in the world. You've got Tarzan, if that's your sort of speed. Like, no matter what you're into, as long as you're into white guys, you probably are into something on stage here.
Yeah, and I do love the fact that they are not all amazing dancers, or amazing dancers in the same way. As you say, that they all have their routine, they have their shtick, you know, which I think is, in my limited knowledge of stripper history, which basically is the musical Gypsy, that there's a song, there's a song in there that's, you know, got to have a gimmick, right? Like, that every, you need to have you need to have shtick to make your, in that case, burlesque character really work. And these guys all have shtick. And it just so happens that, you know, Channing's is being able to move like superhuman, but everybody's got their own thing. And it's, you're totally right, Joey, that they're the components of a boy band. If they were all the same, I think it would be boring. It would be dull for the women in the audience and for us. Like, how much, you know, how many perfect chiseled Abercrombie and Fitch bodies can you watch, you know, however long they're at this club, as opposed to the variety that you have there, something for everybody. I think that's really true.
So, guys, we've talked for about 35 minutes now. I've shown, I think, what I can only imagine is remarkable restraint in not mentioning the fact that my super crush, Riley Keough, is in this movie.
Yeah, which I don't remember.
She showed up, and I wasn't sure you're going to recognize her because you had pink hair.
I mean, I think I'm always going to recognize Riley Keough, my super crush, Riley Keough, even with, you know, different color hair or whatever. But I also did, you know, full disclosure, I did look on Letterboxd and I saw that she was in it, so I had my eyes peeled for her, and when she finally showed up, I was like, yes. And, you know, she is sort of not a monster or not like a villain, but she's not a good person in this movie. She, you know, ultimately leads to the downfall of characters. You know, like, she's this thing, and, you know, there's even that line, like, you don't need that in your life. Like, she is trouble, but man, oh man, like, I am still in love with her. So at the beginning of the movie, we have Olivia Munn, and she's like a stripper, right? Like, she is, you know, that Channing brings her home, and they have that three-way.
No, she's not.
No.
She's gonna be a psychiatrist. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a grad student. No, she's hosting Attack of the Show, which I could not. I'm sorry. Just real quick though, like, when this movie started and Olivia Munn was like in the opening scene topless, like, I couldn't handle it because I've been watching her on Attack of the Show for like all that time, and I just had never been able to really take her seriously as an actor, and I'm not sure I do yet. But she holds her own in this movie. Sorry, I just needed to say my piece on Olivia Munn, who's deathly afraid of balloons.
She came to the club to study them. She was doing a
dissertation.
They were,
I think.
Dissertation, and then which is why she was going to be leaving, and then decides not to. Like, it's because she was only supposed to be there for a certain amount of time doing her research.
Yeah, and then got roped into threesomes and stuff.
Well, no, like she.
No, well she instigated like way. Threesomes. Yeah.
I love her character. I think her character's so great in this movie.
Okay, so I just misinterpreted. So maybe she's not a stripper. So Riley Keough was, I guess, got that pink hair, and she's just also feeding a baby pig out of a baby bottle. Right?
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, and it's sort of this, like, foreboding entrance, too, because it's at the hurricane party. So there's, like, this horrible storm going on outside, and they're just sort of wandering around Dallas's giant house, and I think it's his house, right, if I'm not mistaken, or they're all hanging out at someone's house during the hurricane, and then she's just laying on a bed in a room, like, waiting for anybody to, like, just come in and say hi, I guess, and you know, she reels Adam in and just has him in his grasp, and, you know, that is great advice, but, like, how can you not go in that room?
I sort of forgive the movie's stumbling into this drug betrayal and downfall of Adam's character just because she's the gateway. Like, she's the gatekeeper into this subplot. But, like, you know, it leads him into talking to Fluffy, into talking to Gabriel Iglesias about, you know, getting the hookup for the drugs. And, like, obviously he has more than 100 pills. And, like, it kind of becomes a cliche. And it's just disappointing because, like, you know, I think from the beginning of the movie when Channing has a certain amount of money, like $13,000 saved up. And, like, you know that, like, it's not the kind of movie where things are really going to go well for him. And I was just sort of like, it's like Chekhov's $13,000. Like, I'm like, how is this going to go wrong? Where is he going to have to spend this? How is he going to lose this money in a way that it doesn't behoove him or doesn't benefit him? And, you know, for a movie that is so real and grounded and, you know, about that grind and about that hustle, and, like, so well structured, it's just, like, disappointing how just, you know, cliche and predictable this whole, like, drug downfall is.
Yeah, this is my least favorite part of the movie, and I think it's mercifully short. I think it's probably Soderbergh's least favorite part of the movie too. Like, it feels like he's just, I guess, not just getting through it, but he's getting through it as fast and efficiently as he can. And I think the thing that saves it from, because really the point for the movie, in a more traditional version of this story, it would be about Adam's downfall. And this movie ends up being not about that at that moment. What it's about is what it does to Channing Tatum's character. Like, this is all behind his decision to say, okay, I'm never going to get ahead in this world. I need to find another route. That's what he's gonna decide after this. It's not like, oh, he's, you know, I'm out the money, and it's not self-pitying. It's just a wake-up call kind of for him. I think that in that way, you know, it works for the movie just fine. But it's not, you're right, it's not the most original thing. And it's, I think also the movie's smart enough to know that this is important to have this kind of beat is important to have in the movie, but that we don't really want to spend a lot of time watching it. We want to get back to other stuff. And I think they're smart in the way they deal with it, even if it's not as original as we'd like.
Yeah, I think it's, like, cleverly used as far as cliches go, almost in a, I almost got it in a sense of adaptation, the movie, where so far up until the third act or so, like, this has just been like an adventure in some weird new world for yourself. And so towards the end, I give it a lot of leeway if it needs to fall back on, you know, certain movie cliches, you know, certain things that just that story dictates need to absolutely happen that we've seen a million times. And you guys are absolutely right. Like, it's handled briefly and quickly and cleanly. Yeah. And the screenplay the screenwriter knows well enough not to dwell here in this area, because it's a murky pit that you can get stuck in for a long time, you know. And they really just rush in and out of that. But I do feel like they had to hit that beat, or at least they had to graze it, they had to acknowledge it. And I think, yeah, they did the best that they possibly could there. But I can't imagine, like, another way to get where we need to go, and we need to have that sort of lesson to be learned quickly and hard. I think it adds at least a moment of danger that the movie lacked. The closest we got to actual danger is the sorority party, where they, you know, get into an actual fight with a lot of the guys there and stuff. But I was actually expecting a lot more to go a lot wrong throughout this movie. Like, I thought there was just going to be way more danger, that the Florida nightlife was going to, you know, like, they were just going to be drinking or binging or whatever they were going to be doing and just getting into a lot more trouble. So that when there actually is a moment where there's a moment of a real threat, even if it's just for a fleeting second, I was grateful that we got there and that there's some real consequences on display.
I think the movie needs it, and I think that it's smart to tie it into the Riley Keough character and to the kid being, you know, young, and as you say, Joey, not caring. It's just that the sooner they're done with it, the better. And it's an important sort of place for the movie to go in terms of emotional stakes. And then, yeah, let's move on.
So I think if the thesis statement for Katie's Club and Keanu Club, Mike, as we went through all of those, was, can this guy act? Is he actually a good actor or not? Is he, you know, only good in a few movies? I think sort of the thesis statement of the podcast I do with Joe, too, like Zack Attack and Magic Mike's and Boyfriend Material, and especially, you know, especially this movie, it's like, can these handsome guys be more than just sort of like the heartthrob or like the hunky guy or whatever? And I think, you know, in this movie, and like as we go through Magic Mike's, we're going to find a lot more, but like I think the answer is yes. Like Channing Tatum is great in this.
Yeah, and there's a thing that happens with actors and actresses who are particularly good looking and charming, that it's so easy to underrate what they can do. And I think that he demonstrates, for my money, time and again, but you're right, in that scene and in this movie, that especially when he has control over the project, when he has some say in what it is and how it's being done, he can really deliver. He is not just a pretty face. He's not just a kid who can move. He's a guy who has real chops. And I think that, you know, I defy anybody to watch this movie and not and dismiss that. If they do, I don't think they're really watching it. I think they're just, like you say, they're just sort of laughing at it. And I think that was maybe part of my problem when I first saw it. He was such a big media presence, and I think it sort of kept me from sort of appreciating it as I should have as a film, especially when he's up against, or not up against, but in this movie, he stands out. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean that he is a great vehicle for the audience and really earns those moments.
Initially, I had a hard time taking this movie seriously, or at least I thought I would, because of so much of the spectacle. And, you know, this, I think, came out before I realized Channing had actual chops and could actually go there and do this kind of stuff. But you're right, on its base, like, I think that's part of the point of the movie too. You weren't expecting to take this guy seriously, and by the end of the movie, I think we do, and we take what he does for work seriously, and it's not a joke, you know. And the movie proves that point really well.
We should talk about Brooke.
Do you think she's a good actress? Or do you think that she's like Alex Pettifer in, like, she's serving the role, but she's not great?
I don't know that I've ever seen this actress in anything before or after, but she's kind of aloof to me, the character, but that's what I find really intriguing about her. I want to know what she's about. She's so guarded, and she's not an open book or anything like that. And so, in a weird way, that was sort of refreshing to me. Like, she feels more like a real person. Like, it just seems like in movies, people meet cute so easily and often that they're ready to just, like, talk about everything that's been going on in their lives forever so quickly. And this movie kind of reminded me of more of, like, the way actual people interact.
And, you know, with Brooke, like, I think I've seen her in one or two things, but, like, she reminds me so much of someone in Pitch Perfect. I think maybe that's why I'm confusing her. I'm not sure. I also, I'm not sure if she's a good actor. Like, I don't know if she's good at acting or just like it's hard for me to tell. Like, I can sort of read everyone else in this movie and know whether or not they're good, but like, I'm just not sure about her. And I think, like, what might be leading or contributing to that confusion in a way is that I don't really understand her motivation. Like, she's a sister, but she sort of acts like a mother. And I feel like we don't really get a why there. Like, we don't know why she's so protective and so controlling, other than just maybe, like, an older sister, like, of a fuck-up younger brother or whatever. But, like, I don't know how you write that in and make it feel natural without it being like, oh, well, blah, 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 blah. Like, here's why. I feel like there's probably a smart way to do that. But, like, I don't know the answer, but I know that the movie doesn't really give you one. And that's, you know, sort of disappointing.
I remember when I first saw this movie, watched it at home on DVD with my wife, and she could not stand this actress. She could not, just just did not believe a word of her. And I remember sort of defending it to some degree, although I could see what she was saying. But I remember feeling like, oh, this feels like somebody who's not an actor, who Soderbergh found, and he's working with a non-actor. Because she has kind of a, like, there's no, she has an affectless quality, and it doesn't seem like she's doing very much. But I like that kind of acting. And then, of course, you look on, you know, if you see that she has been acting in various roles for a while. She's done Rescue Me for a few episodes. She's like, she has credits. And then you see that her dad was the chairman of Disney, and before that was Warner Brothers.
Oh.
So she's a mogul's kid, which is not, again, I don't say that as a pejorative, or I don't think she got this job for that reason necessarily.
She might have gotten the audition for that reason.
I mean, listen, Soderbergh and Channing Tatum put the money together to make this movie themselves. They co-financed this movie together, and then it goes on to make worldwide like $160 million. Like,
yeah.
They did very well for themselves. So they had control. They could do whatever they wanted. And there was something I really, this time around, really liked her performance. I'm not sure it's a performance, but I really liked it. I really thought it fit the movie. I think that having her be more stoic allowed the Channing Tatum's charm, like clearly it's half working on her, but not really. And that comes across really, really well, I think. He, the character, Mike, is such a performer, and she is not a performer. And I think that really worked this time.
So do you want more Brooke in the movie?
Look, I don't know how much I want to go into her and Adam's, like, these are, in terms of acting, these are the two most problematic performances in the movie, are the sort of cipher surrogates for the audience in a way, in terms of the world, getting into the world of stripping. Maybe if they were better actors, I would want to delve into that a little more, but I don't know. I didn't miss it. I should say that way. I didn't miss it as I was watching it. As you say that, I think, yeah, that would be kind of interesting to know, but I didn't miss it when I was watching.
Yeah, I feel like they could have maybe slipped in a couple lines. I don't think that we needed to meet their parents or, you know, get the whole story. But I understand. I would like to maybe know a little why she's so overprotective as opposed to just being the older sister and they live without any parental guidance. You know, it could be kind of like a dangerous city if you're out on your own and you're a young teenager and everything. But I quite enjoy her as the person who doesn't buy any of the bullshit, you know, like even as far as like the other women in the movie, how they just so sort of easily like fall for Mike, or, you know, even the Olivia Munn character for the most part, like he calls and she comes running once or twice, you know, and she treats him, you know, the way stereotypically guys treat girls,
yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like that dynamic is like, wow, like we could really unpack that for a while too. Just, I feel like she was, you know, again, more well-written than performed, but I'm glad that this character is there because I feel like it's a kind of character we don't get often in films, and especially a type of female character who I feel is more realistic than what we usually see portrayed as, you know, just in the sense of someone who seems more complex and mysterious, and we're just not going to really get the full picture. It's going to make me feel like they're a little more realistic.
I mean, I'm also totally okay with just tall Paul being in the background and, you know, getting dumped because he doesn't like breakfast foods enough. But I also got the sense, I mean, you said we don't need to meet the parents. I agree. I also get the sense that maybe their parents are dead. Like, that's just sort of the backstory that I gave to them because, like, she's acting like a mom for some reason. And, like, the only thing that makes sense to me is that, like, well, they don't have a mom anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
I actually at one point kind of considered that, you know, I thought, like, I should make up like a reason or something, or, you know, what could it be? And that's kind of the only thing I landed on also, is that they were orphans.
One thing I think we talk about for a little bit. So there's a lot of music in this movie, obviously, because every dance routine has a song. And what's interesting to me, I don't know if I love it, but I think it's definitely unique and it stands out, is that like when there's like the montages of them dancing and there's just a song that's not their song kind of playing over it. I thought that was kind of unique. But what I didn't really notice, which I found on IMDb, is that aside from that sandbar party where there's a song playing, there's no music in the rest of the film.
You mean there's no score?
There's no score. So not only is the rest of the film like tinted yellow or green or whatever, but I think that's another like comparison or difference between, you know, daytime Mike and Magic Mike.
God, he's so good. Soderbergh is so good.
What a subliminal trick they never even picked up on. That takes me all the way back to, was it King of the Hill? When he pulled that editing trick in the very first scene with the shot from the end of the movie, just snuck it in there and he didn't even realize it. In a way, it cooked us for the rest of the film, you know? Like, it prepared us for whatever else was coming along, even if we weren't aware of it, which is awesome. Is that legal? Is he doing like subliminal shit like in his films to get people to like stay in their seats? Is it like they had to ban the old Pepsi commercials because there were subliminal messages in them or something? Like that's the kind of filmmaker it feels like, which is super smart.
Yeah, maybe, although he must not have done it during The Good German unless fall asleep was the command in the subliminal.
You got burnt, Good German. So a little bit of trivia that I found about this movie on IMDb. James Marsden apparently told GQ that he was offered a role in the movie, but turned it down because he was worried his lines would be cutting and look like, quote, a naked extra. So
it must be the Matt Bomer role.
It's funny because basically his lines were cut from X-Men and he stood around looking like a weirdo in the background like most of that movie.
The role of Brooke, the sister, was offered to Jessica Biel, but she declined. I think she would have been good here. And also, in similar sort of fashion in terms of who was almost in the movie, Channing Tatum originally wanted Nicholas Winding Refn to direct the film, but Refn had to turn it down due to scheduling conflicts with Only God Forgives. So I like that Channing Tatum wanted to direct a movie for Magic Mike's, but instead he directed a movie for Boyfriend Material. So no matter what he did, Joe 2 and I are going to cover it.
I don't know. I think there's too much movement in this movie.
I think it'd be the movie closer to what people wanted.
I think he would have gotten too weird and away from the core of it. I think he would too artistically bizarre at points.
Maybe not the female version of this, but I think the Neon Demon is kind of a female counterpoint entrance into this, you know, specific to one gender.
Well, super superficial behind the scenes of those worlds, yeah.
Yeah, but you know the part of this movie that he would have reveled in is the part you didn't like. The thing he does really, really well is sort of menace and like that sort of crazy hurricane party, den of sin kind
of
stuff.
Loss of control and stuff.
Yeah, I don't want to see that. I don't want to see that. I'm so glad he did not direct this movie. There are things he does really well. I can't imagine his version of this movie.
You know what's weird? Having said that, there's things in this movie I wasn't sure Soderbergh was capable of, to be quite honest with you. Like, there's things he hasn't done before, like all this dance stuff. Like, he's getting like Bubsy Berkeley at times with the choreography and the excitement from the crowd and just keeping up that energy.
Except in Haywire, he was working with bodies and choreography in a very similar way. The camera to the action. And when he's shown in the Oceans movies, he can make a fun, pure entertainment movie. I think you combine Oceans and the girlfriend experience in Haywire and you have this movie.
Maybe that's it. Maybe I just seen it in pieces. And so, I mean, it just comes back to the fact that he's just such a great director and like he always knows where to place the audience in a scene and everything to make it just the most understandable. And that's just on full display here. And I mean, just in the coverage of the dancing, especially I noticed this time, I was like, you can screw this up by getting handheld or doing this or doing swooping shots and that. And he's like, no, we're just going to shoot it so you can watch it. And that's just the perfect way to do it.
Well, guys, come back in a couple years for Cinemakers Nicholas Winding Refn, where we can have this argument all over again. Channing Tatum and Alex Pettifer allegedly did not get along on set, which is always a good time, I'm sure, between your two leading roles.
That's unfortunate. There's kind of like a tension that builds between them. At least on the Mike side, you get the sense that he's through with this guy by the end of the movie. You know, that like it's maybe this kid wasn't the best choice.
And my only other note is that at the very end of the movie, when Matthew McConaughey finally does his one and only stripping performance, does at one point a little somersault, like he's down and he's like thrusting his hips in the air and, you know, he's getting showered with money, and then he does this weird little somersault into a stand, and that was because the extras in that scene actually tore his G-string. And so when he does this somersault, like they kept him, he's like holding his junk in place and like the string is dangling. They were just so into it that I'm sure it's not difficult to rip those things, but like, you know, they kept him in the movie, which is pretty great.
Do what you gotta do, man.
All right, all right, all right.
I really think this is the movie he should have won an Oscar for.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is definitely an Oscar-worthy performance out of McConaughey, absolutely.
This is the same year that Mud came out. This is a year after Killer Joe. This is a year before he would win the Oscar in Dallas Buyers Club. It's 2 years before he was Rust Cole in True Detective. I think it's also the year after, or maybe the same year as The Lincoln Lawyer. Like, these are, like, this is like the 3 year stretch where he was just murdering it. And he's so good in this. So he's also the year before Wolf of Wall Street. I mean, I think everybody for the most part is really good in this movie, I think. But like, he and Channing, really, it's just, they're on another level.
He's so good.
And that's the thing. They are on another level, and it shows when they're around, you know, just okay actors or non-actors. That's the one thing. There's maybe a off balance of talent in this as far as that goes, you know. I wish Joe Manganiello even spoke. I don't think he says anything. I liked him in True Blood. Like, he's a good actor. He needed more to do in this. Does he show up in the sequel?
He does. So in the sequel, so his character arc, he's the one who uses the penis pump in this movie, which I think is the first time I've ever seen that in a movie. Maybe the last, who knows?
I mean, I'm surprised there's like actual full-on cock. I mean, I'm just saying, like, I'm a proponent for nudity in film in general, whether it be male or female, just because I have a huge gripe with the ratings board as far as that goes, you know? So I'm just saying, like, it's a win for filmmakers everywhere to get that in.
But in the sequel, he is back, and his character arc is basically that his dick is so big that every time he gets intimate with a lady, they always shy away and they just offer him any kind of other release that's not, you know, intercourse. And so he has to literally find the glass slipper that can accommodate his manhood. It's wonderful, I can tell you that much. Like, the second movie, I don't think it's as good of a movie as the first one. I think that there's lulls in between the action that feel a little bit long, but it's so much fun. It's way more, like, this movie's fun. XXL is so much fun, and it's closer to, I think, the kind of movie that people wanted out of this one, but it doesn't fully sacrifice the story. Like, there's still character development, even if the plot is just like, the plot of the second one is, we're going to go to Charleston, and we're going to enter into a stripping competition. Like, it's a road movie. It's not like this complicated dissection of the American dream and American values and, like, hustling and entrepreneurship and everything, but it is remarkably fun. It's, I think, like, 5 minutes longer than this movie. They amp up the choreography and everything in that movie tenfold, it feels like. They bring in Jada Pinkett Smith, has this entire house, and, like, everybody in the house, both the male strippers and the clientele who she calls the queens, everybody there is black, which brings really much-needed color to this world, this franchise. They bring in a Hispanic dancer named Tito, so they have diversity there, too. We get Elizabeth Banks in the second one. Like, it's so good. It's so much fun. If you liked more about this movie, more than just the, like, financials, which I feel is most people, like, if you were just, like, impressed by the choreography, if you liked the characters, if you liked the acting, the performances, highly, highly recommend the second one.
There's, like, one or two shots of Joe Manganiello, like, behind a sewing machine in this movie. I thought for sure they were going to be, like, he makes the costumes in the second one or something, or, like, he wants to open a clothing store.
Oh, he does some sewing in the second movie. So I don't want to spoil too much more. I mean, not that you can really spoil a road movie that's about, you know, hot guys stripping, but, like, just watch it. I highly recommend it. I didn't appreciate it the first time. I think it works better if you've just seen the first one. You sort of know the characters, know the world. I think that on its own is fun, but, like, they do make direct references. Like, you know, they talk about Brooke. They talk about, like, other developments and stuff like that. To really, truly, fully enjoy it, being familiar with the world of this movie will make the second one even better.
You know what I'm getting a sense of? Like, it might be kind of like that movie Everybody Wants Some, which I loved, that Linklater film. It's just a bunch of guys, like, hanging out 2 days before college starts and their baseball practice. And, like, it's just bullshitting, but it's so great. It's just so much fun.
And, like, I am openly, admittedly, into style over substance. Like, if you give me, like, a flashy movie, like, I am sold. Like, if you give me, like, great sounds, great looking people, because, like, both movies, obviously the stars are all these, like, guys who are shirtless the entire time, but, like, they are perpetually surrounded by gorgeous women. You know what I mean? They're not naked, but they're, I mean, you know, Olivia Munn to Mike's pitter-patter of his heart. But, like, in all the movie, like, they're always in clubs and, like, houses and everything, like, with just beautiful women. Like, it's just, like, beautiful to look at, amazing to listen to. The choreography is there. Like, this is what I want. Like, I want to just have fun in watching movies. And this is exactly what I was looking for.
And that's kind of what amazes me about Soderbergh, is that he's able to do this and Bubble, like, and Kafka and Aaron Brockovich. Like, he has an ability to do so many different kinds of movies, in many cases, really, really well. You know, we may like ones more than others, we may enjoy ones more than others, but, you know, there are a number of directors who can work in a sort of almost esoteric intellectual mode and couldn't make this movie to save their life. Other directors who make movies that sort of where the surface is so much a part of the film, where the aesthetics are maybe more important than the story or the theme or whatever, but couldn't tell a story that was much deeper. And he's able to do both ends of that spectrum in many cases really well. Not always, but in many cases really well. It's partly because he was able to, you know, have the resources to pay for this movie himself. That's not a thing a lot of filmmakers at his level are doing. And I think it allows him to take, as we've said all along, to take a lot of chances along the way. And you know, time and again, it pays off. I'm just so amazed that this fits so neatly into his filmography and yet feels so so distinct.
It also comes in the middle of a 5-film stretch that, like, I dare you to stack up to any other director working today in, let's see here, The Informant, Contagion, Haywire, Magic Mike, Side Effects. We're going to get the Side Effects next week, but like I've only seen that movie once, but I remember really liking
and
it.
And I've never seen it. That's the one that's going to end, like, it's going to fill out my kind of, I will be a completist. Once I see that and the rest of the Nick, I will be all up to date. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how that fits into this really sort of heroic stretch before he retires.
Yeah, seriously, I think I understand why he got the feeling like he could retire now because of this stretch. I mean, but I get the idea. Like, I understand why he was like, I'm going out. I'm going out on top. Like, it reminds me when Chris Rock stopped doing the Chris Rock show. And was like, what are you doing? You have the best show on HBO. This show's amazing. It's such a great talk show. He's like, it can't get any better. I have to leave the show before it dovetails into, you know, terribleness. Like, go out on top. So I understand it. I'm glad he came back to work, but I totally get that, why you would decide to retire after making that streak of movies.
And he must have been exhausted. I mean, Contagion, Haywire, and Magic Mike are released within 18 months of one another. Like, it's amazing how fast he was working. And I think that, you know, back to back to back, and it doesn't really let up. Like, he moves right into both Side Effects and Behind the Candelabra are in the same year too, I think. So he's he must have just been burnt out as well.
But he is back. Maybe better than ever. I mean, maybe Logan Lucky's going to kick off a stretch of films that are even better than this. Who knows? I don't. We don't.
We will find out.
We'll find out. Any last thoughts about Magic Mike?
Go see it. I mean, go rent it. Go watch it. Find it.
Yeah, the same thing. Like, I'm not gonna launch into another long thing. I just want to say, if you're not sure if this is the type of movie for you, give it a try. Check it out, because it's not exactly what you're expecting.
So for all things Cinemakers, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or @cageclubpod on Twitter. You can email us, cinemakers@cageclub.me. Let us know what you think of the show, of the movie, of the episode, whatever. Just say hi. This episode is coming out in March, which means that you can hear a few episodes of Tobin's new show, The Contenders, which is very exciting. By now, for sure, Mike's new show, Third Time's a Charm, will be out, so you can listen to that too. So go listen to all of our shows at cageclub.me. Facebook.com/CageClub and @CageClubPod on Twitter. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I am Tobin Atkin.
And we'll see you next time on Cinemakers.